Okay, so this is about 2:31, and it is September 14th. Remember, I forgot to bring my recorder on Monday, so look to a previous semester for that lecture. And we're going to finish up axial skeleton, move on to appendicular skeleton today. And I think everybody's seeing their score, reviewing their lecture exam, probably from last, when did you have it in here? Last Wednesday was your lecture exam? Oh yeah, because Monday was a holiday. Okay, it's kind of coming back to me. All right, so don't forget, as far as the skeleton is concerned, we can break all the bones in the skeleton down into two main categories. What are those two main categories? It's not working. Axial and appendicular, right, okay. And on this slide, I see axial skeleton, but I see that you can actually break the skull bone down into two compartments. What are the two compartments you can break skull bones into? Cranial and facial, right. All right, so you should know which ones make up the cranium, which one are just facial bones. See, I'm just having a lot of difficulty getting this attached here. But, got it. Okay. So this is a pretty good view. Let's go over some of the bones that are a little bit more obscure when we look at this view right here. Well, the nasal bones are easy to see. They're just on the bridge of the nose, right? But here's a nasal septum. And the nasal septum is made up of how many bones? How many colors do you see in here? Two. Superiorly, it's the ethmoid bone, and in particular, the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone. And the ethmoid bone has some other parts to it that we see within the nasal cavity. And those are the nasal conchae. Sometimes you can think of them as like being little shelves. And they're just covered with a mucous membrane that helps humidify air as you breathe it into your body so your lungs don't dry out. If the air is really hot compared to your body temperature, it cools the air down. If air is really cold, it helps warm the air up. And it absorbs dust particles, humidifies the air. And it also makes the air flow into your nasal passageways and into your lower airways very nicely. It orders the air so that it's not turbulent. So it makes breathing a lot easier, especially, for instance, when you're sleeping, when you're not paying attention to breathing. All right, so nasal conchae do all of those kinds of things. And that's kind of the job of the nasal septum as well. It makes breathing easier because it orders the way air flows in and out of your lungs. All right, so on the ethmoid bone, you got the middle nasal concha, plus also a superior one, which you cannot see on this diagram. And actually, the superior nasal concha, even with the model that we have in lab, is pretty hard to see, but you should at least know it's there. It's one of three pairs, right? So you got superior, middle, and the inferior nasal concha is a bone all by itself. It's the largest of the three, all right, and it's not part of any other bone. All right, so that's the nasal septum made superiorly by the ethmoid. And what bone makes up the inferior part of the nasal septum? That is the vomer, right? And it's a long, narrow bone. It kind of looks like a knife blade, right? And then below that, you have the maxilla. Okay, so I think that's really what the only thing I want to go over on this diagram, except on this illustration right here, you can see the sphenoid bone going from all the way from the left to the right side of the skull and even making up the inferior part of the orbit right here. And the orbit is just a fossa that holds an eyeball. We see some passageways through the sphenoid, like this one right here. This is the optic canal. We're going to pay close attention to that this week in lab when we look at a skull, and there's only one lab section that really needs to find that by itself, optic canal. Then we have orbital fissures right here. These are foramina that are elongated. So they're not really just a foramen, they're an elongated foramen. So here's the superior orbital fissure and inferior orbital fissure right over here, part of the sphenoid bone. This might be an exam figure. I can't quite remember. It's pretty easy to remember all of these things and see the bones on this view right here. That's not too bad. All right, what about, I need to slide this up. Here's a pretty good illustration, right? Albeit a little bit more complicated. This is not an exam figure, but I want to look at this one anyway for just a short period of time. Of course, we can see some of the major bones like temporal and occipital, right here, and you can see the sphenoid bone going back and forth all the way across from right to left, and then a little bit of a zygomatic, okay? But what I want to look at is right in this region right here, which is the roof of the mouth. Sometimes we call this the hard palate, and the hard palate is made up of two different bones, okay? Anteriorly, it is the upper jawbone. What do we call the upper jawbone? Maxilla, right? Because here you can see the teeth. What's the name of that socket that teeth fit into? The alveolus, yeah, and alveolus or alveoli for plural. So remember all those alveoli are what the root of a tooth attaches to, either the mandible or the maxilla in. Here, these teeth in the front are incisors. So here is the incisive foramen. Sometimes it's a fossa. Sometimes it's called a canal. So canal, fossa, foramen, you could call it any of those things in lab. That's fine with me. Okay, and the other bone that makes up the hard palate is the palatine bone. So I see the maxilla anteriorly and the palatine posteriorly, and that separates the oral cavity from the nasal cavity, and of course that separation should be there because otherwise you'd have difficulty breathing and you'd have difficulty eating, right? Because if you eat something, then food would end up in the nasal cavity. That would really be bad. And then of course if you're an infant, and if there's a passageway here, then you can't develop any suction with your mouth. So what happens then if you can't, if you're an infant and you can't develop any suction with your mouth? Unless maybe you teach the infant to close their nostrils off like that. Maybe you could, but of course a newborn baby can't do that. Well, yeah, then you would die because you can't eat, right? If you can't suckle. So that kind of malformation of the hard palate, which we call cleft palate, is really dangerous. Right, for a newborn. It has to be dealt with right away. Alright, so here we have the temporal bone, and here we have the zygomatic bone, and they come together to form this arch, the zygomatic arch. And this projection off the temporal bone is a process. And so how do we name this process right here? It's on the temporal bone. Do we want to call that the temporal process? No, you do not. You want to name a process, right? Not by, if it is articulating with another bone, not by the name of the bone that it's on, but by the name of the bone that it articulates with, right? So this is the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. And then this right here is the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. We've gone over that before, so hopefully it's not so difficult to see right now, but initially it can be pretty hard to see. But I want to use this nomenclature right here to name these processes on the maxilla and the palatine bone. Okay, so here is a process, and it is on what? The maxilla. But do we want to call this the maxillary process? We don't. We want to name it after the bone that it articulates with. And here you can see the nice suture between the palatine and maxilla. So this is actually what? The palatine process of the maxilla, using the same nomenclature that we used over here and even for when we named all the processes on the zygomatic bone. All right, so sometimes people call this process, which is a horizontal plate of the palatine bone, what, the maxillary process, because it attaches to the maxilla, making up the hard palate. All right, but can you see this is horizontal? Because it makes the roof of the mouth. And don't forget, what kind of shape is a palatine bone? The whole shape of the palatine bone is what? It's an L, right? Two L-shaped bones come together like that. So my thumbs would make what? The horizontal plates, making the posterior part of the hard palate. And my index fingers right here help make up the walls of the nasal cavity. So it fits in your skull just like that. So this is a pretty good illustration. You also see these smooth surfaces. What's a smooth surface on a bone for? For articulation, yeah, for a joint or articulation, so that when bones rub up against each other, if the surface is smooth, they don't grind each other away. That's important. And so these are what we call the occipital condyles. This is for articulating with the superior articulating surface on the first vertebrae. Does anybody remember what the name of the first vertebrae is? I think we covered this in all the labs already. C1 is atlas, right, holding up the skull. So it articulates right here. Now, what kind of motion can take place between atlas and the occipital condyle? Is it yes or no? It's a yes motion. We call that flexion and extension officially in anatomy. And when we get to muscles, we'll talk about motions in particular. So yes is allowed between atlas and occipital bone. But can you rotate your head without breaking your neck? I am signing you no, but in truth, you can without breaking your neck. Otherwise, I'd be on the floor right now, right? Okay, so what joint allows for rotation of your cervical spine? The joint between C1 and C2, or between atlas and axis, right, which allows for the rotation between C1 and itself. All right, so I think I pointed out some interesting things here. Don't forget about that vomer that makes that inferior part of the nasal septum right here. But the figure that I find most helpful in your textbook is this one right here. All right, and there's one lab section that doesn't know this yet, but this is going to, part of this figure is going to be a draw and labeling exercise for your next quiz. And what I want you to know, right, for the next quiz in lab, not for this week, but for next week, is to draw and label all the foramina as viewed from inside the cranial vault. So it's going to be a superior view, not that inferior view, which was where? Right here. That's a little bit complicated. All right, so this is the view that I want you to pay attention to. On the left-hand side of the slide, we see some important landmarks. Some of these things you do have to know, but not all of them. All right, but on the right-hand side of this particular figure, you see a number of foramina. Okay, and then foramen magnum is over on the left. That's just a little aberration on the slide. So these are the foramina that I want you to know something about. And we practice this in lab quite a bit so that it's really not such a difficult exercise. Okay, so on this illustration, generally I see an outline of the cranium, and what is that composite bone? What's the name of this composite bone that's been removed? Okay, it's part what? Part frontal bone, part temporal, part parietal, part occipital. So it's just a contrived bone. It's not really one that developed during development, but it's got a name nonetheless. Skull cap. Okay, this is true. But the anatomic name would be calvarium, calvarium. And guess what calvarium means? Skull cap. Okay, so if you put skull cap, everybody will know what you're talking about. Okay, it's a calvarium. That's not anywhere in your book or in your lab list, but it's probably something you should know about. All right, so I see some depressions right here. There is an anterior depression. Bounded by the sphenoid bone right here. So this is what we call the anterior cranial fossa, and it's mostly associated with the frontal bone. So guess what lobes of the brain are in this region right here? The frontal lobes of the brain, right? So it really pays to know a lot of your bone anatomy. Don't forget your bone anatomy once you learn it. Maybe after the test, practice it a little bit so you don't forget it, because it will help you. And then starting with the sphenoid right here, there's another depression. And it's formed mostly by the temporal bones. So guess what lobes of the brain are in this region right here? The temporal lobes. So this is what we call the anterior cranial fossa by the frontal bone. This is what we call the middle cranial fossa, mostly formed by the temporal bones. And then the posterior cranial fossa is formed mainly by the occipital bone, holding what lobe of the brain? And this is just a wild guess on your part, because you never studied it, right? It's just by association and nomenclature. It's going to be what? The occipital lobe of the brain. Okay. So I'm just trying to underscore how important it is to remember the bones when we study bones. Okay. So these hold different parts of the brain. And so that tells you what a fossa is. What is a fossa again for? It's a depression for holding something, right? It's just it's like a bowl. Consider it a bowl. All right, so here we have the ethmoid bone, and we looked at the ethmoid bone previously. What did we say the ethmoid bone, what did it help make up? Yeah, you were kind of crinkling your nose because you were thinking or something. But it does make part of the nasal septum, right, that perpendicular plate, but it also makes part of the floor of the anterior cranial fossa, especially this mid-sagittal section compartment right here. And it's really hard to see in this aspect of the presentation of the ethmoid bone, but there is a big ridge that's poking up into the cranium, and we call that the crista galli. Right? Crista galli is important. It kind of looks like a shark's fin sticking up. attached to that is the membrane that surrounds the brain. So the brain is attached to your skull right here at the crista galli, right? And so that helps prevent your brain from sloshing around when you're riding your bicycle or looking from one side of the blackboard to the other, right? So that's pretty handy. Now, coming off the crista galli are some of these horizontal plates right here. We don't call them horizontal plates. We call these the cribriform plates, and they're filled with foramina, which is what I'm trying to get at. All right, so in order to understand all of these foramina, I want you to know the order at which you would find them if you move from anterior to posterior. Right, if you know the correct order and you have this picture in your mind, then you're going to have really fun on the practicum, as opposed to just taking a kind of wild guess as to what these different foramina are. So what is the sense of olfaction? And that is, maybe I've covered it, can't remember if I covered it with everybody in here, but it's smell, it's a sense of smell. What's the most anterior sense organ on your face? It is your nose. So you would expect to have olfactory foramina, the most anterior foramina. Indeed, here we have them right here. So olfactory foramina in the cribriform plate. Then the next foramen right here is optic canal. Canal is a foramen, but it means it's longer than just a hole in a bone. It's more like a tunnel. And what is the second most anterior sense organ on your face? So your eyes, right? And so that's the optic canal. So the optic nerve goes through there. What sense is allowed by the optic canal, by the optic nerve? Vision, yeah, I like vision. You could say sight, that would be fine, but usually we say vision. So we got olfactory, we've got optic, and then we have three kind of in a row right here. One that's round, called foramen rotundum, one that's kind of oval-shaped, foramen ovale, and one that's really kind of small and spindly, we call that foramen spinosum. They're kind of like right in a line. And these are elevated foramina. There's another one that's in a depression, kind of a dip. And so the bone kind of gets really high right in this region right here and then falls down into this region over here. So if you're out hiking someplace in the local mountains or woods or someplace and you're up on a hill and you look down into a valley, what do you see in a valley typically? What collects down there? Water rolls downhill, usually have a little stream or a lake or something, right? And so that's how this thing was named. This is foramen lacerum. It's like a little puddle right there, but it's a hole, right? So you got what, olfactory, optic, and then these three by their shape, right? Rotundum, ovale, spinosum, and then lacerum down over here, all right? And those are all in what bone? Those are all in the sphenoid bone, except for the olfactory foramina, which are in the ethmoid bone, okay? Well, right in this region, here's the temporal bone. That's not the temporal region normally that we consider on your head when we were growing up, okay? The temporal bone that forms the cranium has some appendage attached to it right over here. What would that be? What am I thinking of? Your ear, right? Okay, and so there is a hole in the temporal bone that allows sound to enter into your skull, okay? And it's called, and it's not on this diagram, but you should kind of know where it is. And what do we call that hole that's associated with your ear? External acoustic meatus, and it's going to be right in this location right here. That's where your ear is. I could actually draw that in, I suppose, if I don't know how to do that with this slide. All right, and just opposite the external acoustic meatus is the internal acoustic meatus. Now, meatus does not go through the temporal bone continuously, right? It is not a patent channel, which means that it's not open all the way. There's an important region right here that contains important sense organs for hearing and balance. There are three regions, three important regions, because you got two special kinds of balance and hearing right in this region. This region of the temporal bone is called the petrous region. So I do want you to know petrous region right in here. It's between what? The internal and external acoustic meatus. And so that's why air can't go from the external acoustic meatus through the internal acoustic meatus right into your brain, because there's a lot of stuff that's in the way, right? It's not just a tunnel going through there. Nonetheless, internal and external acoustic meatus line up very nicely. What else could happen? Oh, I just thought of this. What else could happen if the meatus was patent? Well, your brain could leak out through your ear too. That never happens. All right, so Petrus region is important to know. Then, just posterior to the internal acoustic meatus, we have a really large hole right here. And this allows for blood, all the blood in your brain, to drain back to your heart. And it drains into a vein in your neck first before it gets to your heart. What's that big vein that probably you all knew about before you took anatomy class? Jugular, right? So here's a jugular foramen. And then here's the big foramen grande right here, which we call foramen magnum. That's how your central nervous system leaves the cranial vault, right? So as soon as it gets through foramen magnum, then we consider it part of the spinal cord, not really part of your brain. Lastly then, you have a couple foramina on either side, a little bit anterior on the foramen magnum. That's the hypoglossal canal. That might be the hardest one to remember, because I don't think anybody knows what hypoglossal means in here anyway. Okay, you could look it up. So some of these foramina, you should probably know what goes through there. We've talked about it, like what, olfactory nerves, optic nerves, jugular, for instance. But these are the foramina, and this is how these foramina will be presented for you on a practical test, too. So it'll be from a superior view, won't be an inferior view. Now, the things on the left-hand side are probably pretty important for you to know. We talked about the posterior, middle, and anterior cranial fossa. Anterior cranial fossa, I was looking for it, right? Ethmoid bone, sphenoid bone. Okay, we've got the lesser wing and greater wing is just bigger. There's another name for wing that runs around in anatomy. It doesn't sound like wing at all. And the sacrum has one, and the hip bones have one, and it's called ala, A-L-A, also means a wing. So part of a bone that looks like a wing in somebody's mind is called an ala. Okay. Here's a nice depression. You should certainly know about this depression right here. That's what holds the pituitary gland. What bone is this in? Sphenoid bone, and it's called the sella turcica. Sometimes it's called a hypophyseal fossa. Fossa is just a depression. And so, another name for pituitary is what? The hypophysis. Hypophysis. Hypophyseal is just an adjective, but hypophysis is another name running around for pituitary. When we get to endocrine system, we'll learn something about that. Oh, guess what? Here. Calvarium. I didn't know it was in your book. Here it is. There's one little word right there. Calvaria. Calvarium. Uh-oh. I think calvaria is plural. Maybe I'll have to look that up. Okay, so that's an important exam figure. All right, so for the practicum, okay, go down your lab list and look at these individual bones, right? So you have a nice flash quiz. That's a video that flashes these bones by you, at least be able to recognize this as being a temporal bone, external acoustic meatus, mastoid process, styloid process. What's the function of this mastoid process and the styloid process right here? Muscle attachment. Just always think of muscle attachment. All right, then the squamous region, then part of the zygomatic process. What bone does the zygomatic process articulate with? Ah, the zygomatic bone. That's right, zygomatic bone. Don't forget, that's kind of a mind teaser, right? Just don't say temporal bone because it's on the temporal bone. It's the zygomatic process, all right? Easy to make that kind of mistake. And then here is the joint for the TMJ. Okay, that's pretty good. Sphenoid bone. Important to know something about the sphenoid bone. Right here, so we got greater wing, lesser wing. This is looking from that aspect that we looked at just previously on the whole skull. Right, so here's the sella turcica. This is just the body of the sphenoid right underneath the sella turcica. And here's the optic canal. And probably when you're in lab, you should take two of those little wooden toothpicks. Actually, they're really big toothpicks. Not really a toothpick, just wooden sticks. And stick one stick in the left optic canal and stick the other one in the right optic canal. And it's going to form a letter. Has anybody ever done that in lab? What kind of letter does it form? Yeah, that's right, because one stick is going to come like this, and the other one is going to come down over like that, and it's going to form an X. And that's, you should keep that in your mind, because that's going to model how the nervous system, the architecture of the nervous system, is built up. But it also means how if you know something about the structure, you also understand something about what? About how vision functions in your brain compared to where your eyes are. Because what you see with your right visual field, both with your right and left eye, your right visual field goes over to the left side of the brain, and what you see on with your left visual field crosses over and goes to your other side, the right part of the brain, because of the way those optic nerves go through here. All right, so what else we got? Optic canal, foramen rotundum, ovale, and spinosum. Can you tell this is foramen ovale? Really easy, because it's a nice oval shape, so that's not too bad. What about this is the view that I wanted to show you. All right, so here's a posterior view. So this is superior surface. This is the inferior part of the sphenoid bone. You can see the greater and lesser wing again. Here's that superior orbital fissure that we mentioned before. Here's the body of the sphenoid, and in this region is the solitursica. But this is what I want you to see right here. These bony projections, these are processes. So what's the function of these projections right here? Muscle attachment. And guess what the name of the muscles are that attach here? Funny spelling. The P is silent. So this is the pterygoid muscles. We've got a couple of pterygoid muscles that attach right here. This is what? Above your mandible? At the level of your mandible or below your mandible? The sphenoid bone. Where's your sphenoid bone at? Here. Where's your mandible? Below it. And what is a muscle specialized to do? It's specialized for contracting, right? A muscle can't really push, but they only can contract. So if that muscle contracts, guess what happens to your mandible? It elevates the mandible for chewing. Okay, pterygoids are important for chewing. So again, that kind of underscores how important it is to not forget anything about your bones, because it will make your life a lot easier if you remember things about bones. All right, so that's a nice sphenoid. Here's a pretty good view that shows some things, like that nice incisive foramen in what bone? What bone is the incisive foramen in? The maxilla, okay. So here I can see the palatine process of the maxilla. Is that what that says? Oh, good. Why do we call that the palatine process? Because it articulates with the palatine bone right over here. The other bone in the posterior part of the roof of the mouth. This is you could call this the maxillary process of the palatine bone, or you could call it horizontal plate, either one. All right, so this is an illustration of pretty much mid-sagittal, at least in this region right here. So in your nasal cavity, what do you have on a mid-sagittal section of the nasal cavity? You have your nasal septum right there. So what bones make up the nasal septum? Superiorly, it is the ethmoid bone, and then inferiorly is this really long, narrow one, which is the vomer right in here. Okay, other things that I see on this slide, which are nice besides things that you know about already, like this internal acoustic meatus, but I see some holes in bones of the skull. What do we call these holes right here? And think of the long form of this word, not the short form, because there's a short form, sinus. What is it? It's a paranasal sinus, right? Paranasal sinus. So here is the frontal paranasal sinus. And here's the sphenoid bone. So these are the sphenoid paranasal sinuses. And, that's all we see. But the ethmoid has them, as well as maxilla. But you would have to go off midline in order to find those. So here's two of four paranasal sinuses, right? The frontal and sphenoid. These you can see very nicely with the mannequins that we have in lab. So the torso models are really good. All right, so here are those pterygoid processes again. The mandible has some important parts to it. Like the body of the mandible is right here. What is this region called? Mental region. Yeah, mental region. You have a couple of mental foramina right in there. All right, the mandible also has another foramen on the interior surface, the medial surface of the mandibular ramus. Right, and we call that the mandibular foramen. Right, don't forget about that one. A lot of you will be dealing with that one, I'm sure, because there's a nerve that goes through there that innervates various teeth. right? So if you have your teeth worked on, that nerve should be anesthetized, unless you're an expert in hypnosis or something, I suppose. But whoever gets a cavity filled in here, anybody in here ever get a cavity filled without anesthesia? You do? Far out.
I don't like that.
You don't like anesthesia? Is that what you said? Oh, you don't like needles. Okay. Can be done. It can be done. Okay. So, okay. Talk to your fellow student down here if you want to know how it's done. Okay. Okay, then here is the mandibular condyle. Okay. So I don't think this is an exam figure, but it's a little complicated, but you should maybe look this over. What do you have between the internal acoustic meatus and the external acoustic meatus? What part of the temporal bone is that? What part of the temporal bone is that? You might want to say squamous, but aha, that's not really true. Squamous region is way up here. What is that region between internal and external acoustic meatus? That's the petrous region of the temporal bone. Okay. Well, here we see the ethmoid. Don't forget that ethmoid is like my favorite bone in the skull right here. Here's that, what is this little shark's fin sticking up? Oh, it says right there, crista galli. All right, and then you have some horizontal plates. What are those horizontal plates that come off either side of the crista galli horizontally like this? The cribriform plate. And what's noteworthy about the cribriform plate? What does it have? Olfactory foramina, right? So you can see how close this is to your nasal cavity. And that's kind of strange because that's the only place I know in the whole human body where you have part of your nervous system actually dangling outside your body. So you have those optic nerves dangling through that cribriform plate into your nasal cavity right there. So they have a really hard life. So I'm not surprised that some people lose their sense of smell because everything you breathe in can just attach themselves to those nerve fibers right there, right? And it can damage them as well. And they probably get old really fast and don't do their job. All right, so that's bones, some bones of the skull. Don't forget about that hyoid bone. And I think in your pre-lecture reading assignment, it asks you to list what bones make up the orbit, what bones make up the nasal cavity. So you should have those lists in mind when you, for taking the lecture exam now for the practicum, for instance. Okay, and don't forget all those pre-lecture reading assignments. I think maybe on Monday, I'll try to remember to send everybody an email, but on Monday, as you come into class, oh, but you guys are here so much earlier than I am. I would like for you to show me that you're actually doing those pre-lecture reading assignments. Okay? And as a matter of fact, right now, I would like for you to raise your hand if there are two conditions. If you do the pre-lecture reading assignment, number one, and number two, if you find it helpful. More importantly, if you find it helpful, raise your hand, the pre-lecture reading assignments. All right, that's cool. So everybody who's not doing them, you might want to look around the room and see that there's a lot of people that actually find them to be beneficial. I know they take some time to do, and we haven't talked about it yet, but it really sets you up to learn a lot from lecture when that happens. All right, so that information you're not getting from me. It's from your peers in the class, right? So I think that's important. Okay. So what else about the axial skeleton do we have to know something about? Vertebral column and rib cage. Okay, and I think we talked about this last time. The vertebral column has got five major regions. From superior to inferior is cervical, which is your neck, thoracic, which helps make up the thoracic cage. And what bones have to articulate with a thoracic vertebrae? Ribs, right? So by definition, if a vertebrae has a rib attached to it, it's thoracic. If there is no rib attached to it, it can't be thoracic. It's got to be some other kind of rib, like cervical or lumbar. And you also have to know how many vertebrae that are typically found in these different regions. 7 in cervical region, 12 thoracic, 5 lumbar, right? 5 in the sacral region. Sacral region is a little funny because what can you tell me about all those vertebrae that make up the sacrum? Yeah, they're fused together. It's immovable. Those can't flex or extend, can't rotate. Okay, and the same thing for the coccygeal vertebrae, they're all fused together as well. And there's typically about four of them. And we talked to, I remember talking about this now, curvatures of the spine. You have some anterior curvatures, some posterior curvatures. All right, what do these posterior curvatures allow for? Like in the thoracic region and the pelvic region right here. Yeah, allows for internal organs, visceral organs to occupy space right here, like pelvic organs. And in the thoracic region, lungs and heart. And what about these anterior curvatures in the lumbar and cervical region? Why are they there? To help position weight so that it's over your hip bones. Right? Because if everything was posterior, right, then you would fall backwards. You wouldn't be balanced. So it just helps position your head more anteriorly to help counterbalance the organs in the pelvic region and thoracic region that are a little bit posterior. All right, so here is something that you should probably be able to draw out. This is a typical vertebrae. All right, and anteriorly you have the massive vertebral body, which supports the weight of your body. And in between vertebral bodies, you have the intervertebral disc, which is fibrocartilage. Coming off the body, you have a bony plate right through here and right through here. It's armor plating that protects the spinal cord that moves through the vertebral foramen. So what do we call this bony plate between the vertebral body and this transverse process? That's a pedicle, right? And between a transverse process and the spiny process, the other bony plate is the lamina. And if you put the lamina and pedicles together, that forms the vertebral arch, right? So be aware of these different locations right here. What's the function of a transverse process? Muscle attachment, lots of muscles, hundreds of muscles in your back, so that we can stand up erect. And also, I see a smooth surface right here for what? For articulation. Any kind of smooth surface on a bone is an articulation. This is a facet. And the tubercle of a rib will attach right here. Where does the head of a rib attach? The head of the rib is the very tip, right? And the very tip is going to articulate here. So this is the facet for articulation with the head of a rib, and this is for the tubercle, so a rib is going to attach and then go around anteriorly like that. Okay, so we'll be able to draw this out. I think we talked about everything there, spinous vertebral foramen. If we take a number of vertebrae and line them up so that they form a nice column, then if we look down through this vertebral foramen, we're going to find the vertebral canal. Okay, so foramen we have in one vertebrae, but if they all line up perfectly and you have that all the foramina lined up, then it becomes the vertebral canal. Okay, so maybe I can see it on this illustration right here. Yeah, here's a nice, probably an MRI of some kind. Here are some vertebral bodies here and here and here. Here are some intervertebral discs. Okay, and then here's some spinous processes right here. And then I see a number of vertebral foramina here and here, and if we align them all together and I see some spinal cord in there, it becomes the what? Vertebral canal. Okay. All right, so thoracic cage, made up of sternum and ribs. How many thoracic vertebrae were there again? Because you have lunch at what time? You have lunch at noon, right? So typically you have 12 thoracic vertebrae, which means how many pairs of ribs? 12, right? Because they're attached to the vertebrae. So here I can see the head of a rib attaching to a vertebral body right here, right? And then it courses around. There are 12 of them. The first 7 articulate with the sternum directly via some costal cartilage. So 1 through 7 are what we call true ribs. Even this one right here is a true rib because here's the cartilage and it goes directly to the body of the sternum. Now rib number 8, which is this one right here, notice this cartilage right here doesn't go to the sternum. Where does it articulate with? It stops on the costal cartilage of rib number 7. So this is the first false rib because it doesn't go directly to the sternum. So 8 through 12 are false ribs, Right, so here's a little dinky costal cartilage. Certainly that doesn't go to the sternum. And then ribs 11 and 12 have no cartilage on them whatsoever. And since they don't have any cartilage attaching to the sternum directly, that can't be a true rib. So these are false ribs, but they're also called floating ribs because they have no cartilage on them whatsoever. Okay, so that's ribs 11 and 12. All right, and the sternum right here. Make sure you know the three parts of the sternum: manubrium, the body, and the xiphoid process. And that xiphoid process is an important landmark to know where the sternum is. That's really important for CPR, because when somebody's heart isn't beating, you can beat their heart for them by doing what kind of exercise? Chest compressions. And you can't push on this xiphoid process because it's going to snap off and a broken bone is really sharp. So that will cause a lot of internal lacerations if you do that. So you just palpate for the xiphoid process, move superiorly. And what do they teach you in CPR? Two fingers, three fingers, or what? Two fingers typically? For making sure you do chest compressions on the body of the sternum instead of the xiphoid process. I think you find the xiphoid process, put two fingers on it, and then you're pretty much above it. Okay. Okay, how about a rib? Let's take a look at a rib. So here's a rib. The superior surface of a rib is pretty blunt and round. The inferior surface of a rib is very narrow and kind of sharp. So you can tell what the superior part is versus the inferior. And that might be important because this costal groove right here is in your lab manual, is something to know. And that's going to be on the more inferior aspect of the rib, right? And a lot of ribs, you can't see it with your eye, but you can palpate it with your fingertips. So just run the interior, inferior surface of a rib to find that costal groove. And there are blood vessels and nerves that find their way from one end of the rib to the other through this little groove or sulcus. Remember, groove or sulcus is the same name. So this is the cost. Anytime you hear costal, what part of your body should you be thinking of? Rib, right? Like the costal cartilage is a rib cartilage. Okay. So here is the shaft of the rib and the angle. All right, and the very tip over here, which articulates with the body of a vertebrae, this is what we call the head. All right, and then this narrowing part is the neck. And then you might think, well, this other broad part underneath the neck is the shoulder. But we don't call it a shoulder. On your body, we might call it a shoulder. But on a rib, we're going to call it a tubercle. All right, so here is a tubercle. It's a kind of small process. Right, so this part, the head of the rib, articulates with the vertebral body. The tubercle of a rib articulates with the transverse process of a vertebrae. So let's see where that happens. So here's a nice typical vertebrae. Here's the head. Here's the neck of a rib. And then here's the tubercle. So you can see the head, bless you, the head of a rib articulates with the vertebral body and the tubercle with the transverse process right here. So in lab, walk over to the skeleton, see how that fits so nicely together. Or at your table, just put them together like that. Okay, now don't forget, most ribs don't articulate with just one vertebrae. The head of a rib will articulate with two, an inferior and a superior body. So this articulating surface right here is doing half the job of the joint. So sometimes we call this a demifacet. Oh, on this diagram it's called a facet, but this is like half of the facet. Where would you find half of the other facet? On the vertebral body that's superior to this one, right? So sometimes we call this a demifacet, meaning half of a facet right here. Okay, so I think, let me look over this list. Make sure you know all your landmarks by name. We haven't talked about a malleolus yet, all right? But a spine is a process that's really long and narrow. A line is really long but not very raised up, but a spine is very high. A fossa, sulcus, groove, alveolus, these are all depressions. A hole has different names. The most common one is foramen. Meatus is one that does not go all the way through a bone. Canal is more like a tunnel. A fissure is like a foramen, but it's very elongated. And some bones have holes in them on the inside, and we would call that a sinus or a cavity. Okay, and we just got done talking about a facet. That's a smooth surface for articulation, all right, as well as head on a bone is for articulation. Condyle is smooth for articulation. And then when we get to appendicular skeleton, trochlea and capitulum are special articulating surfaces on the humerus. And we started to look at that in lab today a little bit. All right, so what do we call a 90 degree of part of a bone that bends away from the body of a bone at a 90 degree angle? That's a ramus, yeah. Like the mandible has a ramus on them. Okay, so we looked at all of these things, sternum and curvatures. All right, so that's your introduction to some bones. So let's move on to the next chapter. What do you think the next chapter is going to be? Appendicular skeleton. And that's going to be a pretty fun chapter because you're really more familiar with those kinds of bones. 6, 7, 8, I think that's chapter 8. Okay. That's nice. All right, so don't forget, all the bones in your body can be broken down into axial and appendicular. So we're kind of done with axial skeleton. Moving on to appendicular skeleton, which means what? Appendages. Oh, wait, no. I did this already. Where do I want to go? Okay. I don't have a picture of a skeleton in this chapter, but you have a picture of a skeleton. Okay, in your book, if you have your books. All right, so think of your axial skeleton as being maybe the major part of your skeleton. Everything else is going to be attached to the axial skeleton, including your appendages. So you got an upper appendage and a lower appendage, and you don't really want to say arm. Why don't you want to say arm? Because where's your arm? It's between your shoulder and your elbow, and then you'd be leaving out your forearm and your wrist and your hand, right? And digits as well. All right, so say upper appendage. So your upper appendage, which I see a little bit of right here, is attached to the axial skeleton via some bony framework. And that bony framework surrounds your thoracic cavity. And if you have something that surrounds your body or a body or something else, what do we call a structure that surrounds something? It's called a girdle. Okay? Or it could be used as a verb. To girdle something is to what? Surround them, right? You could girdle a tree. Girdling a tree means that you cut the bark off all the way around the tree and then the tree dies, right? All right, so what are the bones that form a girdle on the superior part of your thoracic cavity? There are bones in your back and some bones in your anterior. Your collarbone is one of them, and your scapula is the other, and you've got pairs of both of those, so they completely surround your thoracic cavity, so they're a girdle. And your upper appendage attaches to those bones, and those bones then attach your arm to your axial skeleton. So that's what we call the pectoral girdle. The bones that make the pectoral girdle are the clavicle and the scapula that we see right here. All right, now the scapula does not articulate with any bones of the axial skeleton. The scapula articulates with the humerus, which is in your arm. All right, but there's got to be a bone that articulates with your axial skeleton, and it is the clavicle. The only joint that is holding your whole upper appendage to your axial skeleton is between the clavicle and the manubrium right here. All right, so that sometimes we call that the manubrioclavicular joint. And everything else that's holding your arm to your body are muscles. So I know you guys want to get the muscles soon, but we'll get to them soon. So the scapula, depending on how you look at it, well, no matter if you look at it from above or below, kind of looks like an S right here. And it's got both ends of the bone are very broad, right? So it kind of flares out I see a little flare right over here. And with just looking at a picture, it's hard to tell which end is which. So in lab, you got to get a clavicle out, and you will appreciate that this end over here, which is a lateral end, we call this the acromial end, attaches to, articulates with the scapula, is very thin, right? So can you see that the distance from top to bottom is about the same distance as the top to bottom over here? So it's pretty thin, but if you go from anterior to posterior, it's very broad. So the acromial end kind of looks like a spatula or a knife, but the sternal end over here, right, no matter how you turn it, it's still going to be thick. It kind of looks like the opening of a clarinet or a trumpet. Right, that's something that's really hard to appreciate with just a picture. So that's an important remark, because when you start to study bones for a practicum, it's difficult to know what to put on a practicum if you just study figures, because you don't see enough of the bone to really get a good appreciation for what it looks like in real life. So it's important to come to lab and really look and see what the models are like. So the acromial end in real life looks vastly different than the sternal end, but on these pictures they look what? Kind of similar, right? They look kind of similar. All right, but the sternal end is much bigger, much broader in all respects compared to this acromial end in real life. Here is a tubercle. Right, so there's an important ligament that attaches that tubercle that helps stabilize the shoulder joint. And so that is the clavicle. I'll make some more comments about the clavicle in lab. So that's anterior part of the pectoral girdle. The posterior part, the scapula right here, is not the most difficult bone to appreciate in your body, but it looks a little bit more complicated than some of the ones that we've been looking at so far. But not too bad. It has a couple main features that I want you to look at. It's got a noteworthy posterior part and an anterior part, so to help you understand how it fits in your body, as well as medial and lateral. So here is your humerus, right? And that's lateral compared to the scapula. It attaches, the head of the humerus attaches to a depression in the scapula that we call the glenoid cavity. And I think I want to flip one slide. Here is the glenoid cavity. It's a depression, or you could call it, if it's a depression, what else could you call this? Fossa. And a lot of books call it the glenoid fossa, same thing. But glenoid is going to be referring to your shoulder joint. So the head of the humerus fits into this location right here. So if the humerus, let's go back one, if the humerus is attaching to this glenoid fossa, is this the medial or lateral aspect of the scapula? Where do you have your arm? In the middle of your body or laterally? It's going to be laterally, right? So here is the nice lateral margin of the scapula, which means here is the medial region, right? And indeed, they're named medial border and then lateral border over here. But always just look to find this glenoid cavity to get you started, because you know your arms are, your humerus is lateral. Okay, so again, a fossa is a depression for holding something. You can feel this bony prominence called the scapular spine on your back right here. And it goes from medial all the way laterally. And as a matter of fact, this process kind of sticks off of the scapular spine. It's called the acromial process, and you can palpate that pretty easily as well. So the acromium is just a continuous piece of the scapular spine that forms your shoulder. And the scapular spine helps form a couple fossa on this part of the scapula. And this part of the scapula is what, anterior or posterior? If you can feel it with your fingertips, it's got to be what? It's got to be posterior, right? All right, so here is a depression, and here's a depression down here. The one above the spine is called the supraspinous fossa. Supra means on top, like the supraorbital foramen or notch, right, is above. And then the infraspinous fossa is below the spine of the scapula. And these two things hold something, and what they hold are muscles. And I could quiz you on what the names of these muscles, and I would guess that if you know the names of these fossa, you could tell me the names of the muscles now. So if this is the supraspinous fossa, this is going to hold the supraspinatus, right? Or you could get close anyway, close enough to get point for it. And then this would be the infraspinous muscle down over here. And that makes perfect sense because here's the spine of the scapula. Okay, here we have the inferior angle, superior angle, the suprascapular notch we see in some scapula, right, the acromion process. And then there's another pretty impressive process on the scapula. We call that the coracoid process. And that bends around anteriorly and kind of looks like a big beak on a bird, maybe a raven or a blackbird or something right here. And I can see it in this diagram right here. So that's a nice posterior part of the scapula. And what about the anterior part? Which way? That's facing anteriorly, but could you ever palpate that with your fingertips? No, it's deep because it's in your back, right? So you can't palpate with that with your fingertips like you can this anterior part. So here's a posterior view of the scapula, and again, we can see the inferior angle, the superior border, and what border is this over here? You see this as being the medial border because what about this glenoid cavity? That's got to be lateral, right? So here's a lateral border. There's that nice acromion process. Now, what I can't see is what that acromion process is attached to. What is it attached to? If you look through the scapula, what's going to be over here? It's going to be the spine, scapular spine. It's a big ridge, right? So when you pick this up in lab, it will make a lot of sense. So coracoid process, acromion process. And now here is that glenoid cavity right here for articulating with the head of the humerus, which we're going to get to really, really soon. All right, so how many fossa, how many different little depressions does the scapula have? Okay, here's one right here. Oh, I didn't mention this one yet. Subscapular fossa, right? That's on the anterior part of the scapula. You can't palpate this one with your fingertips. Oh, there's a muscle in here. All right, so what would be the name of this muscle? That would be called the subscapularis, right? So you guys are learning a lot, just not your bones. So don't forget your bones. All right, so how many different fossa are there? Let's count them. Here is the subscapular fossa. Here is the infraspinous fossa. And here's the supraspinous fossa. And then there's one more. Where's the other one? The glenoid fossa right here. You could call it cavity. All right, so there are four fossa on the scapula. All right, in your lab list, there's something that I want you to know. If we look at this projection right here, this is pretty good. There's a little rough area, a little raised rough area below the glenoid cavity, below the glenoid fossa. It's called a tubercle, and since it's below, we call it the infraglenoid tubercle, and there's going to be one above it right here, and we call that the supraglenoid tubercle because there's a glenoid cavity. Those are for muscle attachment. All right, those attachment points are on opposite sides of the glenoid cavity. One is superior, one's inferior. All right, and these are going to, you're going to relate these to two different muscles on opposite sides of your arm. Okay, they attach to the scapula on opposite sides of the glenoid cavity. The two muscles, well, one muscle, I'll tell you, is the biceps. Okay, what muscle? That you might know this. What muscle is on the opposite side of your arm? You got biceps on anterior compartment. You've got triceps on the other. Now, here's a symmetry that I want you to appreciate. And that is, when the biceps contracts, that moves your hand toward your face. We call that flexion. Guess what happens when the triceps contracts? Opposite motion. We call that extension. It's going to take your hand away. Okay? That's probably the most important concept in anatomy or physiology that I want you to appreciate. You have many systems in your body that work against each other. We call that antagonism. But because you have antagonistic systems, right, you have nice, precise control of balance of where this fingertip is going. So that later on this week, maybe Friday night, when you get pulled over by that person with the flashing lights on their car and the sidearm and badge and everything, and they say, put your fingertip on your nose, you can do that, right? Because you're not intoxicated, you could say, oh, officer, I have nice, precise, antagonistic control of my fingertip right here and explain it all to him, okay? And I'm sure very shortly he would be more than happy to release you, all right, to the general public once again. So think of what? Opposite sides of the glenoid cavity for the attachment of opposing muscles, right, that give you precise control and balance. And if you want to use a yin and yang example in your mind from philosophy, that's fine too, to help reinforce that concept. All right, so supraglenoid tubercle, infraglenoid tubercle on the scapula. All right, let's move on to bones of the arm. How many bones do you have in your arm? Tricky question. I hear a couple of bones. I hear three, five, bunch. But guess what? There's only one. Because where's your arm once again? Shoulder and elbow, right there. And here's that bone in your arm. And it is the humerus, right? So here is the proximal epiphysis. Here's the distal epiphysis down here. And then here's a nice diaphysis. You got to know some of these things. All right, here's a smooth articulating surface on the humerus. What does this articulate with? The glenoid cavity. If you want to say glenoid fossa, that would be fine with me. And it's a big bony prominence. It's very thick and massive. It hardly ever fractures. And then I see a little narrowing. Can you see? I see a little dark area right here that's supposed to represent like a little groove or sulcus through here. That's what we call the neck. Right? Indeed, it's a little bit of a narrow place by... Before we get to the tubercles right here, tubercles are processes for muscle attachment. Okay, and then the bone indeed does get narrow as we approach the diaphysis. All right, so sometimes this area, oh, it's not on this slide right here, it's in your lab manual. This is what we call the surgical neck. All right, so the anatomical neck is this place right here, but it's still a massive part of the bone. It does not fracture very frequently here. But what can you tell me about the surgical neck? It's a place of fracture commonly found, right? So that's why we call that the surgical neck. In between the tubercles, the greater and lesser tubercle, lesser just means that it is not as big as the greater one, there is a groove. What's another name for a groove? A sulcus, right? So here is the intertubercular sulcus or groove, and part of the biceps tendon goes up between these tubercles right here and inserts into that supraglenoid tubercle that we were just talking about. So there's got to be a little place for that tendon from the biceps to go through here. This is an anterior view of the humerus. We're going to look at a posterior view in just a little bit. And then mid-diaphysis, there's a rough raised area, which is a process for muscle attachment, and it's called the deltoid tuberosity. And what aspect of the humerus do I have the cursor going down? Is this medial or lateral? Medial or lateral right here. Look at the head. It's medial because it's going to articulate with the scapula, which is medial. All right, so here's the lateral part of the humerus, and that's where this deltoid tuberosity is. And now you know the name of the muscle that attaches right there. All right, it's on a lateral aspect, and when it contracts, produces this kind of motion, and you can actually feel that muscle contract, at least I can, because it's a big, massive muscle right over here, okay, when it's contracting. And what's the name of that muscle? Now you know. If you didn't know before taking this class, that is the deltoid muscle, right? So it attaches to the deltoid tuberosity. So again, please don't forget any of your bone anatomy. It really helps. Then, on the distal epiphysis, you have some smooth articulating surfaces right here. There are two of them, and that relates to the number of bones that you have in your forearm. How many bones do you have in your forearm? You've got two, okay? You've got a radius and ulna, and laterally is the radius, medially is the ulna, and it's not shown on this diagram right here, but you should probably know that, okay, sooner rather than later. So here's the forearm. The lateral one is the radius. The medial one is the ulna. A lot of times, okay, we want to check to see if somebody's heart is beating and how fast it's beating. We can count their pulse, their heartbeats. How can we do that? There is an artery. There's a bunch of arteries that go through their forearm. One that's really easy to palpate is just right superior to your thumb. And in anatomic position, which way is the thumb facing? Laterally, yeah, outward. Okay, so I can feel that pulse. And remember, we said that's the radius. That's lateral. So guess what the name of that artery is? Radial artery. So that's why a lot of times when you take somebody's pulse, we say, well, just get a radial pulse on them, and you can just put your palpate, your fingers right on the radial artery, which represents the radius bone right here, corresponds to the radial bone. Okay, that also sometimes we could also call that pulse what? Not just radial pulse, but it's far away from your heart. Another way of talking about that is what? Proximal or distal? Distal, right? Distal pulse. Okay. So here we've got medial on the humerus. Here is lateral. The capitulum right here articulates with a bone in your forearm, right? And which one is it? The medial or lateral one? Lateral one. What's the name of the lateral one? The radius. So capitulum articulates with the radius. And then the trochlea, which kind of looks like a little spool or bobbin you wind up thread on, right here, this articulates with the medial bone in the forearm. So what bone is that? That's the ulna. So you're going to have to look at that a little bit. Trochlea articulates with the ulna, capitulum with the radius. So these are two special articulating surfaces, because look what you can do with your forearm. Okay? You can flex and extend, but what else can you do? You can do this really fancy motion. We call this pronation and supination. When we get to muscles, we'll learn some of these motions. And that means that the radius has to cross over the ulna. It's got to have special articulating surfaces. Okay, which we call capitulum for radius, trochlea for ulna. These broad regions right here, above the condylar surfaces, epi means on top of. So these are the epicondyles. Here's the medial epicondyle. Does that make sense? Sure, here's the head. And here's the lateral epicondyle right here. All right, so I'm going to stop right here, and we're going to continue with appendicular skeleton next time. So look over some of those bones for Monday, and do that is it a good idea to do that pre-lecture reading assignment?
That's a good idea. And you like to do them. Because it's more fun to come to lecture after you do them.
Yeah.
People didn't do good?
No, it's really hard for people the first time. Yeah. But you know what? There's a really huge, steep learning curve. And people start to do really well. But yeah, the first test is really hard for a lot of people. Yeah.